This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the last few years of Ira Gershwin's life, his assistant was my guest, Michael Feinstein. Feinstein couldn't have asked for a better break. He was a young performer and ardent music fan. Through his association with Gershwin, Feinstein learned the stories behind many songs and was introduced to other songwriters he got to know. Over the years, he's put together an incredible collection of rare recordings that he found in songwriters' homes, Hollywood studio vaults, and Hollywood area flea markets. Today he's going to play some of those recordings for us. But first we're going to hear one of his own performances. Feinstein has become one of the best-known interpreters of American popular song. He's recorded many CDs and has won 3 Grammys. His latest CD is called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Here's a track from it, a song Fred Astaire sang in the film The Bandwagon.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'll go my way by myself. Love is only a dance. I'll try to apply myself and teach my heart how to sing. I'll go my way by myself, like a bird on the wing. I'll face the unknown. I'll build
Michael Feinstein from his new CD, Michael Feinstein, with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Michael Feinstein, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, over the years, you've gotten to know several great composers who are still alive or were still alive when you were younger. And you have some rare home recordings that some of them have made, and you've brought a couple of those with you today. In a moment, we're going to hear Harry Warren singing one of his most famous songs. But before we do that, where does Harry Warren fit into your rankings of the great songwriters?
Harry Warren, to me, is at the top of the list, certainly if not greater than Irving Berlin, equal to Irving Berlin. I know there are people probably collectively raising their eyebrows, but a lot of people don't know the scope of Harry's achievement. Even though he primarily wrote only music, his contribution to American popular song is mighty. He actually had more hits on the hit parade than even Irving Berlin. And Berlin was actually jealous of Harry, and they had a feud going for quite some time. It was during the Second World War that when Harry heard that the Allies bombed Germany, he turned to a friend and said, they bombed the wrong Berlin.
What are some of your favorite and well-known Harry Warren songs?
I'll String Along With You, one of my absolute favorites, September in the Rain. I love a lot of his ballads because he was influenced by Puccini. I was very close to Harry, and he had a lot of records of Puccini. We would frequently listen to Puccini operas, and he was very proud of this manuscript page in Puccini's hand from La Boheme. So it is those beautiful Italian ballads that make me most think of him.
He wrote some of the songs for the Busby Berkeley films of the 30s, and one of his most famous songs is Lullaby of Broadway. You have a home recording of Harry Warren singing the song. How did you get access to this? Where'd you find it?
I met Harry Warren through Ira Gershwin. Harry and Ira had last collaborated in 1948 for the Barclays of Broadway, an MGM film that was starring Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And I had begged Ira to introduce me to Harry, and once I met Harry, we became very close. I spent for 3 years, my mornings at Harry Warren's and afternoons at Ira Gershwin's. And Harry had these stacks and stacks of recordings, most of which had never been cataloged, and I found these RCA pre-grooved home recordings that he had made in the 30s, and then had the great joy of listening to them and transcribing the music on them. And this was one of these home recordings he made just for his own fun.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Harry Warren, recorded at home, doing his song Lullaby of Broadway.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway, the hidey-high and poop-a-doo, the lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of the subway train, the rattle of the taxi, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's, when the Broadway baby says goodnight. It's early in the morning, Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby, good night. Milkman's on his way. Sleep tight. Let's call it a day, hey. Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway.
That's songwriter Harry Warren, recorded at home in 1935. My guest is Michael Feinstein, who's brought with him some terrific, rare recordings like this one. And this is a real treat to hear because it's not like Harry Warren performed a lot. He wasn't like George Gershwin, who would perform at the drop of a hat.
Very true. Harry was a guy who was very shy and didn't play the piano very well. He used to say, Berlin plays with one finger, Kern plays with two, and I play with three. But he was not ebullient as a performer. And you can hear there's kind of a monotone quality to that performance, but I still love it.
Now, you also brought with you a home recording that you got, you say, from Ira Gershwin's closet.
Yes.
Back when you were working with Ira Gershwin. And this is a recording of Harold Arlen singing at a party. Tell us about this recording.
Well, this is very interesting, Terry, because when I first started working for Ira Gershwin, he actually hired me to catalog his phonograph records, and he used to call me his demon discographer. And I found a number of these home recordings that were not labeled that were in Ira's closet. And these were things that had been made on a machine that he once had. And there was a whole set of recordings from a party he had around 1938 that included Harold Arlen, Yip Harburg, Milton Ager, who wrote Happy Days of Harrigan, Doc McGonagall, who wrote comedy sketches for Beatrice Lilly, Harold's wife Anya Arlen, who was a Goldwyn girl, Leonore Gershwin. And I found this one recording, which was all beat up but still playable, of a song sung by Harold, but it's a song I had never heard of and it wasn't documented anywhere. When I saw Yip Harburg a couple months after discovering it, I said, Yip, did you write this song? And I sang him a couple lines. He said, no, that had to be written by Ted Kohler. Those rhymes, he said, oh, those awful rhymes. Don't know which way to lean, betwixt and between. He said, that had to be Ted Kohler. He was very pejorative. Nevertheless, I think it's a delightful song.
And who's singing the Fats Waller-ish kind of backup vocal here?
Oh, you mean that sort of, who got you shit?
That's exactly.
That's Doc McGonagall, and then you'll hear Yip Harburg, who says, take that bridge back out of your mouth, boy. And Ira's the one who's saying, what's all this talk about a wall and then talk about a fence? So they're all just hanging around, just having a good time, and nettling Harold, who barely manages to get through the song.
So this is Harold Arlen singing a song he wrote the music for, and he's at the piano, too?
Yes.
Okay, and this is, what year is this?
1938.
Okay.
You've got me sitting on the fence. Don't know which way to lean. Oh, Doc, you've got me sitting on the fence. I'm betwixt and between. Like Humpty Dumpty, I'll soon be slipping off that wall. And if I got to go before I go, I want to know which way to fall. The little things you do, because you know my hands are tied. Now that I'm running after you, I hope you're satisfied. Why do you keep me in suspense? How would you like to be in
love with someone and be sitting on the fence like me.
You got me sitting on the fence.
Who's got you sitting on that fence?
Don't know which way to lean.
Oh, you know which way to lean, all right, you
rascal. You got me sitting on the fence.
What fence?
I'm betwixt and between.
You get between it? The devil and the deep blue
silly position.
What's that you said?
Be slipping off the wall.
Why don't you talk about a wall and I talk about a fence?
Why can't I go before I go? I wanna know.
That's Harold Arlen singing it at the piano. It was recorded in 1938 on a home recording. My guest is Michael Feinstein, who found this recording in Ira Gershwin's closet. Feinstein worked with Ira Gershwin for many years. And Feinstein has a new recording himself. This one is called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Michael Feinstein, how did you start working with lyricist Ira Gershwin? What a terribly lucky break to have.
It was wonderful to work with Ira because I had idolized his work for so long. I met him through June Levant, less than a year after I moved to Los Angeles.
This was Oscar Levant's wife?
Exactly. She was Oscar's widow, and I met her after I found a series of recordings that were home recordings of Oscar Levant's in a used record shop in Hollywood. I got June Levant's phone number through a lady I was working with at a piano store. I had taken a job as a piano salesman thinking that I needed to get, quote, a real job because I didn't think that I could really make a living playing the piano and singing. And June and I became friends. I met her because of these recordings, and she was very, very sweet because she recognized something in me that was unusual for a kid of 20 years old, and that was an enthusiasm and a great knowledge of not only Oscar Levant's music but the Gershwins and all the other contemporary songwriters of that time. And so she created an introduction to Ira, and so in July of 1977, there I was sitting in Ira Gershwin's living room, and he asked me to start working for him, taking care of his memorabilia.
What did that mean? What exactly were your responsibilities?
My first responsibility was cataloging the records in the phonograph room. Ira was in a deep depression because his closest friend, Eddie Carter, had just died. Eddie was Raymond Chandler's literary agent, and when he retired, he started working with Ira as a secretary just for fun, just to hang around with Ira. And Eddie died of cancer, and Ira was just in this funk, and his wife, Leonore, was trying to find some way to bring Ira out of it. And when they met me, Mrs. Gershwin realized that I was somebody who would probably bring new blood and new life to Ira, and she pulled me aside and said, I want you to do whatever you want in this house. She said, I'm going to open up every closet and drawer, and you can find whatever you want, create your own duties. But most of all, she said, I want you to keep Ira happy. And so I was doing this cataloging work, but I was doing it alongside Ira so I could engage him. And so if I play an old record, he'd respond to it, or I'd find a lyric sheet or find a manuscript of an unpublished Gershwin song to show to him. And it really brought him back. And it was the most extraordinary experience because I was actually being paid to spend time with this person who was one of my idols.
My guest is Michael Feinstein. He has a new CD called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. They'll do an American tour next month. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Feinstein, one of today's most popular interpreters of American popular song. He also collects rare and archival recordings of American popular song. He's brought some of them with him. When we left off, we were talking about the years he spent working as Ira Gershwin's assistant. How old was he when you started working with him?
He was 80 years old, and he was very reclusive. He was housebound at that time, and eventually he became bedroom bound. He got out of bed, but he never left the bedroom. And he was alert and sharp and bright and funny and very much a father or a grandfather figure to me. He was very, very sweet, very shy. He was so shy that he rarely went to parties. He absolutely retreated into this little shell. And after his brother George died in 1937, at the age of 38, he never quite recovered from that.
You obviously want to hear all of his more obscure songs and obscure home recordings. Did he want to hear that too?
He did, because he loved the memories that they brought back to him. Some of his favorite songs were not necessarily songs that were hits. For example, Love Walked In is a song that he didn't like very much. My Cousin in Milwaukee is a song that he loved, and that's a song that was hardly recorded at all.
You want to recite a little or sing a little of the lyric for that?
I've got a cousin in Milwaukee. She's got a voice so squawky, but makes your heart get kind of gawky 9 times out of 10. Now let's see the bridge. When she sings hot, you can't be solemn. Sends the shivers up and down your spinal column. When she sings blue, the men shout, what stuff? That baby is hot stuff. So the bridge, the whole idea of the bridge is that when she sings hot, the people had the reaction of hearing the blues, and when she'd sing the blues, it sounded like a hot song. So that's why she was all mixed up.
So what do you think of the song? Did you share his enthusiasm for it?
I think it's an adorable song. I like it musically. It's a bit of an antique lyrically, because it's a certain kind of song that was written for a Polish comedian named Lida Roberti. And the reason Ira used the word hot is because she was famous for saying the word hot as chat. So she'd say, I got a cousin in Milwaukee. When he sings chat, I can't. So the whole thing was putting that ch sound. So it was really written for a specific performer. But Ira loved it, so there we are.
No, when you talk to Ira Gershwin about songs, would he give you little lessons in lyric writing?
Oh, yes, yes. He not only would instruct me as to different sorts of rhymes, as to what was appropriate and what was not, but also how to interpret a song, as he did with Someone to Watch Over Me, as it nettled him that most singers would sing in the bridge of Someone to Watch Over Me. Although he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome, to my heart he carries the key. And the rhyme is, he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome. And he was always teaching me to look for those inner rhymes and those little special twists that sometimes singers miss.
I want to get to another recording that you've brought with you. This is another home recording. It's a home recording of a very obscure Ira Gershwin song, a song I think you helped rediscover, called Ask Me Again. What's the story behind this song?
Oh, well, this was one of Ira's favorite unpublished Gershwin songs. There was a cache of unknown Gershwin songs that Ira had been holding back all those years since his brother had died in 1937, and he didn't know what to do with them. They were like little diamonds, and he wanted to release them to the public, but he wanted them to be released in a way that they would get attention, that they would mean something, because he knew that if he just published them, that they would fall by the wayside. So he was always hoping to find a project to put these songs into, something that would make them important. And he never found the project that did that. So in 1983, the year of his death, I had taken this one song, Ask Me Again, which was originally written around 1930 for Girl Crazy, and asked Rosemary Clooney if she would sing it while I recorded it, because I was hoping that if I heard Rosemary sing it, then he would agree to allow us to perform it and to release it to the public. I recorded Rosemary doing it. She did a marvelous, marvelous interpretation of it just off the cuff. And Ira listened to it, and he said, my God, it sounds like I wrote that song 50 years ago just waiting for Rosemary to sing it. And I said, can she sing it? He said, oh, yes. And he allowed it to be introduced for the first time a couple of months after that home recording was made.
Well, let's listen to this 1983 home recording that you made with you at the piano, Rosemary Clooney singing, the recording you made to convince Ira Gershwin to let you introduce the song. Here it is.
Ask me again, who's the one I've begun to adore? Ask me again, who's the partner my heart clamors for? Tied in a bow knot, so that I know not just where I'm at. Who is it makes my friends all find that I've a one-track heart? tell how I fell from the stars. One look and then couldn't govern the love in my heart. Who is it I looked high and low for? Whom will I go for my whole life through? Please ask me again. Let me shout to the world it's you.
That's Rosemary Clooney with my guest Michael Feinstein at the piano, a home recording made in 1983, a song by George and Ira Gershwin, a really beautiful song. And how wonderful to hear Rosemary Clooney. You must be so sorry about losing her. I know you were very close.
She was like my second mother. She called me her sixth child, and I've been waking up every day thinking of her. I just loved her so much, and when I hear her voice, it just takes me into a special place in my heart. There was something so special. She was so gifted, and we're so lucky that she was around in our time.
Michael Feinstein will be back in the second half of the show. He has a new recording called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Feinstein. He has a new recording with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Feinstein not only performs American popular song, he collects home recordings of singers and songwriters, as well as rare recordings from Hollywood vaults and lost radio broadcasts. He's brought several recordings from his collection to play for us. Here's one he got from Rosemary Clooney, featuring her singing on her 24th birthday as the orchestra takes her by surprise.
Sweet Leilani, heavenly flower, nature fashioned roses kissed with dew. And then she placed them in a bower. It was the start of you. Sweet Leilani.
Rosemary Clooney recorded on her 24th birthday. It's one of the recordings Michael Feinstein brought with him. He was very close to Rosemary Clooney. Did you get to know her through Ira Gershwin? Because if I remember correctly, she was Ira Gershwin's next-door neighbor and then ended up moving into his house after he died. Do I have that right?
Close. She was Ira's next-door neighbor, yes. She actually, in 1953, with her then-husband, Jose Ferrer, bought a house that had been occupied by Ira and George in 1936 and 1937. When George Gershwin died, Ira moved out of the house that Rosemary later bought, and in 1940 he bought the house that was next door to the house he had originally occupied. So Ira bought a house in 1940 at 1021 Roxbury, and in 1953 Rosemary and Joe Ferrer bought the house at 1019 Roxbury.
And is that how you got to know her?
Yes, we actually met through kitty cats, because Rosemary had some cats, and Lee and Ira had one cat that they had actually stolen from Polly Bergen, who lived another two doors down. It's a long story, and Polly, when I mentioned that, she said, Polly said, "Yeah, that bitch, she stole my cat," referring to Leonor. But in any event, Lee was very concerned that Rosemary wasn't taking proper care of her cat, because the cat would always come to the Gershwin house to eat the shrimp that Leonor left out. Now, what cat is going to go home and eat its own food when Mrs. Gershwin is leaving shrimp? But in any event, I went next door, and it was because of their cat that I met Rosemary, and she invited me in, and I stayed for a long time.
Well, you've brought with you, one of the rare recordings you've brought with you is an outtake of Rosemary Clooney on Bob Hope's radio show recorded in April of 1954. Well, say something about this before we hear it. Introduce it for us.
Well, 1954 was a year when magnetic tape recording had become standard usage for radio. Before 1950, everything was done live, or most things were done live. And by that period in the 1950s, everybody was recording the shows and then editing later, which I guess lost some spontaneity, but also allowed good stuff to be captured. In this instance, Bob was asking Rosemary about her husband, Jose Ferrer, and asking about the relationship. They'd only been married about a year. And Rosemary gave a response that in those days was not appropriate to use on the airwaves.
A little naughty for the time.
Quite.
Well, let's hear it. And this is Bob Hope asking Rosemary Clooney about her husband, Jose Ferrer.
Rosemary, you are one of the world's greatest exponents of lowbrow, bebop, and jazz. Joe is one of the world's finest Shakespearean actors and is considered very highbrow. How do you two get along intellectually?
Intellectually?
Yeah.
We meet somewhere around the middle. I mean, we're both kind of middle brow.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
That's mighty fine country through there. Oh, I love that.
Oh, what shears on this show.
Oh,
huh?
I love that.
The scissors. Oh.
Oh, I wish we could use that, too.
That's Rosemary Clooney, an outtake from her appearance on the Bob Hope radio show in 1954. My guest, Michael Feinstein, brought with him several rare recordings and outtakes. He has a new CD of his own called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. No, you know, in addition to performing, you're also a song collector. And the great thing is you put the two together by performing, in addition to popular songs, some very rare songs. And you've scoured flea markets and homes and basements and movie studios as well. How have you gotten access to movie studios looking for outtakes and forgotten recordings?
My initial access came because of Ira Gershwin. Ira wrote me a letter of introduction that allowed me to get into the RKO studios in the late 70s. And it was possible because of him quite frequently, because in the early days I was looking for Gershwin materials. But after I became somewhat known, a lot of studio librarians and archivists would let me in because they knew that my intentions were pure.
As opposed to?
Well, sometimes there are problems with pilfering from studios. Frequently things are stolen and things disappear, and there are certain items that are still in the hands of private collectors that have been lifted from the studios. In some instances, this is a good thing because studios have thrown things away and they have been recovered because collectors have gathered them. But there also has been the underhanded side of that. For example, there's an outtake from A Star Is Born, the Judy Garland version, that still is in the hands of a private collector. And the guy claims he doesn't have it, but I believe that he does. And it's just stuck there. Nobody can get it.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your greatest finds from going through movie studio archives?
One of the most exciting things for me was going to RKO in those days when they were just getting ready to throw out boxes of these discs. And I found Fred Astaire outtakes, Frank Sinatra outtakes that were just used as part of the Sinatra in Hollywood box that came out, a Crosby outtake, a complete version of Fred Astaire singing Change Partners, which differs drastically from the way it was done in the film Carefree. I found amazing Bing Crosby things that have turned up through the years. Three of his lost Woodbury Show broadcasts that are legendary with the Boswell sisters. And that's one of my most exciting finds because Crosby is one of my favorite singers.
One of the things that you've brought with you is a recording of Jean Harlow singing. Now, Jean Harlow was not famous for her singing with good reason. And in fact, she didn't even sing in the final version of the film. She was dubbed. So what's the story behind this vocal that you have?
Well, this was a vocal recorded for a 1935 MGM film called Reckless, and we're able to play it through the courtesy of MGM. The song was written by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein, even though you wouldn't know that if you weren't told that. And Harlow, like all the MGM stars of that period, were expected to sing, and she absolutely could not sing, but they still insisted on it. So she recorded a vocal, if you want to call it that, I mean, it's so bad, of just a couple of lines of this thing, they did several takes, and they realized that they just were not going to be able to use it. And she was replaced in the final film by Shirley Ross. So this is the unused Harlow vocal for Reckless.
I've made my mind up that here I'll wind up. I'll take what's coming to me.
That's Jean Harlow's unused vocal for the 1935 film Reckless. Michael Feinstein, you've also brought with you the dubbed version, the version Shirley Ross made for her. And should we give that one a spin?
Yes, and hearing it, you'd never know, seeing it rather on screen, you'd never know that that wasn't Jean Harlow singing.
I've made my mind up that here I'll wind up, I'll take what's coming to me.
Now, do you think that recording we just heard of Shirley Ross dubbing for Jean Harlow, do you think that that's Shirley Ross's regular singing voice, or did she try to assume a voice that she thought Harlow might have if Harlow could only sing?
From other recordings I've heard by Shirley Ross, I think that the latter is true. I think that she tried to approximate what Jean would sound like if she had pipes.
My guest is Michael Feinstein. He has a new CD called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. We'll talk more and listen more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Feinstein, one of today's more popular interpreters of American popular song. He also collects rare and archival recordings of American popular song. He's brought some of them with him. Now, another session you've brought with you, one of your finds, is a Judy Garland outtake from Annie, Get Your Gun. She was cast in the movie before Betty Hutton got the part. Why didn't she stay with the film?
As I understand it, she was simply too ill, that she was not showing up on time on the set, and they finally had to fire her. She was devastated at that, but clearly she was in no condition to work, and she was holding up the production. The budget was going haywire because she had become so unreliable because she just wasn't well. And it's no secret that the studio was working her too hard, and they asked her to come back to work at that point much too soon, and she had begged them to take more time off before that, and she simply couldn't do it. She did record a set of soundtracks for the whole film, and she's in varying vocal shape through those sessions. On some of them she sounds terrible, and some of them she sounds better. This thing that I've brought is the unedited session where Judy keeps missing a line, and she sounds like she's in decent shape that day, but she's supposed to sing, "There's no business like show business if you tell me it's so," and she keeps singing like, "No business I know," and she misses it once, then she laughs and she says to Roger Edens, who did the layout and her mentor, she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Roger," and finally she gets it. And from that unedited session that you're going to hear, they did splice together what was the finished vocal version.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Judy Garland, an outtake from Annie, Get Your Gun, the film.
The opening, when your heart beats like a drum. The closing, when the customers won't come.
There's no business. Oh, I'm sorry. Gee, I couldn't see it. All right, keep the same tempo. Keep the same tempo.
When the customers won't come.
There's no business like show business, like no business. I'm sorry, Roger.
Yeah, cause it's the music.
When the customers won't come.
There's no business like show business if you tell me it's so.
Traveling through the country is so thrilling. Standing out in front on opening night. Smiling as you watch the benches filling and see your billing up there in lights.
There's no people like show people. They smile when they are lost.
Even
even with the turkey that you know will fold.
You may be stranded out in the cold.
Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold.
Let's go on with our show. Let's go on with the show.
That was Judy Garland singing with Frank Morgan, Howard Keel, and Keenan Wynn. It's one of the rare recordings that my guest Michael Feinstein has brought with him. Michael Feinstein has a new CD in which he sings accompanied by the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Now, you know, we've been talking about some of the outtakes and home recordings you've collected over the years and some of the composers who you got to know over the years. You've actually recorded with a couple of those composers. One of those recordings was an album of duets you made with Hugh Martin, who along with Ralph Blaine wrote the Trolley song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, The Boy Next Door, and some other very great but, you know, lesser known songs. How did you get to know Hugh Martin?
I met Hugh Martin in the 80s. I had written him a letter because I was recording an obscure song of his that he had written with Marshall Behrer called Wasn't It Romantic? And I asked if he would record the accompaniment for me to sing it. And he was very reclusive at that point, and he said, I will make a recording of the accompaniment for you, but I'm not seeing anybody right now. And he did record it, and I sent him a tape of the finished version, and he sent me a note saying that he cried when he heard it. And he invited me over, and I met him and got to know him, and he has become one of my treasured friends. He's now, I believe, 87 years old and extraordinarily facile and still writing songs.
Well, I'm a big fan of his. Why don't we listen to a duet that you recorded with him of one of his lesser-known songs called I Never Felt Better. Tell me about this song and why you chose it to be on the CD.
I Never Felt Better is, I'd say, trademark Hugh Martin. The wonderful harmonics of the song, the optimism and the spirit in this number is quintessential Hugh. It's a song that was written for a movie called Athena, which is not a good film, but has a great score. And I really wanted to sing the song because I was hoping and am hoping that it will lead people to that score, which is undeservedly obscure.
Okay, well, here's Michael Feinstein with Hugh Martin from an album of duets that they did of songs by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine.
The days I go out shopping, I buy each thing I see. I charge them, then I feel I got them free. So where will I receive my mail? Jail, but I never felt better, so I'm cruising full sail.
How's your appetite?
Tremendous.
How's your energy?
Stupendous.
Are you strong?
So strong I have to watch my step.
How's your eyes?
Bright as a penny.
And your sleep?
I don't need any, but I'm always on the ball and full of pep.
How's your heart?
It must be ticking, cause I feel alive and kicking.
How's your brain?
Well, it's insane, but kinda quick.
How's your love life?
I got plenty.
How's your vision?
2020 must confess that I'm depressingly unsick. If I'm to cross the ocean, better learn to float.
It's Michael Feinstein with Hugh Martin at the piano and doing some duetting there from the CD. Michael Feinstein sings the Hugh Martin songbook. Michael Feinstein also has a new CD called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Did Hugh Martin tell you any songwriting stories that stuck with you and changed the way you hear one of his songs?
Well, he told me stories about a lot of songwriters because Hugh did vocal arrangements on Broadway for Jerome Kern, for Vernon Duke. He did Cabin in the Sky, for Richard Rodgers, for Irving Berlin, for Arthur Schwartz, and for Johnny Green. So he was telling me stories about all these guys. One of the things that stuck with me was that of all these writers he worked with, including Kern, who was notoriously difficult, Richard Rodgers, who is also known famously as being difficult. He said the only person who was truly unkind to him was Irving Berlin. And I've never forgotten that because Hugh was writing these very advanced vocal arrangements that were advancing the whole sound of Broadway. He was writing sort of these swing things that were much more complex harmonically than was currently heard on Broadway. Berlin was very paranoid about people stealing from him. He was always worried that people were going to try and take something away from him, which I find extraordinary, but something that was characteristic of him throughout his career, corroborated by other stories. But Hugh was doing vocal arrangements for Berlin for Louisiana Purchase, and Berlin was constantly riding you and concerned that he was going to make too many changes that was going to deviate from the structure of Berlin's song to the point that he would have to give Hugh some sort of credit for his interpolations in it. And Hugh said that even though Rogers was was known as being difficult, he was a pussycat with Hugh and Kern, Berlin was the one who had this sort of paranoia that he could not overcome.
My guest is Michael Feinstein. He has a new CD called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Feinstein, one of today's most popular interpreters of American popular song. He also collects rare and archival recordings of American popular song. He's brought some of them with him. When we left off, we were talking about Irving Berlin. Did you ever meet Irving Berlin yourself?
I did not meet Berlin. I used to speak to him on the phone when he called Ira Gershwin. And later, at the urging of Liza Minnelli, I called Berlin when my Irving Berlin album came out. And it was something I, to this day, regret having done because it was very embarrassing. Berlin was very hard of hearing. And nobody ever called Irving Berlin. He always called you. But Liza, being wonderful and persuasive, said, "Michael, here." And she dialed the number and handed me the phone. I heard a man say, "Hello?" And I said, "I'd like to speak to Mr. Berlin." "Who's calling?" I said, "My name is Michael Feinstein." He said, "Who?" "Michael Feinstein." "Who?" "Michael Feinstein. What does he want with Mr. Berlin?" As if he's not Berlin speaking, you know. And I said, "Well, I was told by his lawyer that he loves my new album." "What?" "I was told by his lawyer that," I was repeating myself again, "I can't hear you." So finally I got it out, and he heard me. He said, "Oh, for Christ's sake, forget about him." And he hung up on me. So that was my conversation with Irving Berlin.
Did it make you feel any different about recording his songs?
No, it didn't. And as a matter of fact, Rosemary Clooney told me that when she did an album of Berlin songs, and she was quite close to him, she called him up afterwards and said, "Well, Irving, what do you think?" He said, "Well, there were one or two things that I really liked on there."
So everybody thought he was kind of cranky, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Burton Lane said that opening night of Finian's Rainbow, which was, it just smelled of success. It was such a huge hit. During intermission, Berlin came racing up the aisle and ran smack into Burton Lane, whose songs he published early in Burton's career. And he looked at him and said, "Hi, Burton, where's Yip?" Looking for Yip Harburg, the lyricist, and then ran away. And Burton said, "Can you believe it that he couldn't pay me a compliment? He just couldn't find it in his skin to say, it's wonderful."
Yeah. Michael Feinstein's my guest. He has a new CD called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, and he's brought with him some rare recordings and outtakes. You know, a lot of us who love American popular song worry that it's, you know, that the audience has shrunken a lot, that people aren't writing great songs like that as much anymore. For quite a while, some of those songs were really associated with a kind of gay sensibility, but I think it's a generational thing that a lot of gay men don't know these songs at all, and I'm not sure it really is at all a part of the kind of quote gay sensibility of the younger generation. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I do, because I think that you're quite right that a lot of younger gay men and women don't know this material. I think it is a generational thing where a lot of it has disappeared. However, my audiences are definitely demographically younger than they were a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is due to the proliferation of jazz moving more and more into the mainstream, with Diana Krall and other performers who have had extraordinary success singing standards. And therefore, people discover these songs either through Diana's recordings or as the end title of a movie, if it's Someone to Watch Over Me, sung by Sting or Annie Lennox, or hearing it on a commercial. There are so many different places that this music is heard that has made it the fabric of our time that it does survive. I used to worry greatly because I thought that a lot of my audience was dying either due to old age or to AIDS, as there has been a decimation of the gay community, of course, and so many people who were the keepers of the flame of this material have left us. But I truly feel that the legacy will go on and on, and certainly the audiences that I have make me feel quite secure in saying that.
Well, Michael Feinstein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a true pleasure.
Michael Feinstein has a new CD on which he's accompanied by the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Here's the closing track from the CD, a song by composer Jerry Herman from his show Mac and Mabel.
I won't send roses or hold the door. I won't remember which dress you wore. My heart is too much in control. The lack of romance in my soul will turn you gray, kid. So stay away, kid. Forget my shoulder when you're in need. Forgetting birthdays is guaranteed. And should I love you, you would be the last to know. I won't send roses. And roses suit you.